And welcome to Local Color. Today I am speaking with Alton Takayama Chung, a world-renowned storyteller and oral history collector. Alton has researched and gathered tales from many cultures to recount stories from a variety from Japanese-American experience before, during, and after World War II to Asian folk tales, ghost stories, and legends from Hawaii. He has served as the chairman of the National Storytelling Network and has been awarded for his performances around the globe. Mr. Chung, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Please tell us, if you don't mind, how growing up in Hawaii influenced your storytelling.
I never set out to be a storyteller, but you know, in Hawaii, I think everyone's a storyteller, just to begin with. You tell a joke, you're a storyteller. You tell people how was your day, you're a storyteller. And in Hawaii, it was like, we did things like, instead of gossiping, we call it talk story. Everyone just sits and talks story. But everyone would share stories in and amongst groups of friends. And that was my first, you know, inkling, I guess, of stories. And the first stories I heard, of course, were folk tales and then ghost stories. Everyone has ghost stories in Hawaii. But I was so scared as a kid that I would just cover my ears and walk away because these things were so real to me. When I started getting serious about storytelling, I said, well, let me go back to my roots, telling ghost stories from what I remember, from what I heard and what I grew up with. And I said, that's something that, you know, it's part of me and it's something that I should continue on.
How do you craft a story for a specific group, or your process, or your research? Is that kind of a too huge of a topic to address?
Well, we'll try. lots of times, I'll hear about a story, or someone will commission me to go and write a story about a specific topic, and I'll just start diving into the research. Like, I just spent the last 3 years working on immigration of the Chinese into the Pacific Northwest. A foundation was interested in me performing a story about that, and we had no idea how to do this. And so I just immersed myself in just the facts and the history and what was going on and what was important. You know, as I start reading and researching, little things will start surfacing, little items. And again, you think about, you know, what level of audience are you going to be performing this for? They were interested in writing something for the fourth grade level, and I had not written anything for the fourth grade level in a long time, and I didn't quite have my head around how to do this. Draft after draft after draft, and finally said, no, this is not working. We need to really bring down, you know, the level of this thing. So I said, all right. So finally, we got something, you know, how reduce the vocabulary, shorten the sentences, and really kind of, you know, because as if we're telling stories to people with English as a second language, because that's really what our target audience was, underprivileged students in the Seattle area. And from there, it's just a matter of working. And then once you've got the story, you know, we have to make sure that the facts are there. But we also have an arc of a story. You know, a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. The beginning is, you know, there's an issue, there's a problem. The middle is, okay, and things get worse and worse and worse at the very end. And suddenly, you know, things are resolved, you know, and you come to resolution and there's transformation. You come to some conclusion about life. And that's a general idea of the arc of a story. So a story has to have that to begin with. That's the backbone for me. And then all the other details, you hang on to that. And so that you paint the picture that way. And so that's how I would, you know, I would craft a story. I just immerse myself in the facts. And then what has to happen? What kind of tension needs to be there? In this particular story, it was just, you know, it was a cultural investigator who was telling the story of the Chinese immigration from artifacts. But I had done so much research that I realized, you know, there's another story here that I really want to tell to adults. So I took that story and I rewrote it again for adults. This time it's first person, from the eyes of the person that story actually happened to. And the underlying story of that one is that Chinese in the 1850s believed if you passed away far from home, that your spirit would not rest until your bones rest with the bones of your ancestors back in the village graveyard back in China. And so that was the whole premise of the whole story. And I said, okay, you know, I created two characters, two best friends. They leave China to go to the gold rush. They work the railroads, and then they come to the Pacific Northwest, and they go their separate ways. And they make a promise to each other that, you know, whoever dies first, the other one will make sure to send the bones of his friend back to China. One of the men get killed, and his body is lost. And now the survivor is writing a letter home to the village saying, I'm sorry, but I cannot send his bones home because I don't know where they are. To me, that was the whole story right there. And then everything that happens after that, all factually true, meticulously researched. But to me, that's the arc of the story. And that's how so now I've got two stories, one from the fourth grade level, one from the adults. And they're telling the same story from different viewpoints. A clue of what I do in my process.
Which is wonderful. It sounds like it's collecting the oral histories and doing the research. You just must come into like so many. It must be easy to get distracted, I would think.
Oh, definitely. I mean, another project that I have, I was commissioned to write the life story of Spark Matsunaga, the junior senator from Hawaii, who was instrumental in pushing the Japanese-American Redress Bill through Congress in the late 80s. So I was commissioned to go and do that. You know, I read his biography. I went through, all his personal papers were donated to the University of Hawaii in the special collections. So I went to the special collections, I made my request. I got hold of all his personal papers. I went through a lot of his personal papers because he was also a poet. And so I, you know, got copies of his actual handwritten poetry that he had done. And then I went in, you know, was able to go and speak to his children, get their impressions of their father, crafted this story about, you know, this man's life. And, you know, whose viewpoint? I said, okay, it's not going to be his personal, it's going to be a friend of his. And so it's another person talking about his friend's life. And
the foil kind of thing.
Yeah, but, you know, because, you know, that, and then I also, you know, massive research into the University of Hawaii collection, going through the congressional record, you know, and looking up all the things that people had said after he had passed, you know, and things like that. So lots and lots of research, and yeah, lots of details and things you will never know, but you uncover little tiny gems, like, you know, that he wrote a haiku poem. You know, here is the Japanese prime minister coming visiting Washington, D.C., and he says, oh, look at all the cherry blossoms are in bloom. And he just recites this haiku about, you know, how, you know, blossoms here and, you know, in Washington and, you know, east does meet west here. I don't remember exactly what the poem was, but it was the prime minister was so impressed that he asked for a copy of that haiku. And little tiny things like, you know, when he was wounded, he served in the 100th Battalion, 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II in Italy, and he was wounded. And here he is writing, he's convalescing in a hospital in Naples, and he's writing poetry about the nurses and about the doctors and things like that from, you know, from his standpoint. These little tiny glimpses that he's seen. And yet you see the humanity of the man, like these people. He's known for anyone from coming from Hawaii who came to Washington, D.C., who contacted his office, he would take them out to lunch because he served in the House of Representatives as well as in the Senate. And the first time it happened, like in 63, I think, his friend calls him up and says, hey, I've got this elderly couple. They're coming. They lived in Maui. They're coming to visit Washington, D.C. Would you show them around? He said, of course. So he takes them around the Capitol and he takes them to lunch. And then they're taking pictures and he's about to say goodbye. And this old man who hasn't said anything to him says, you know, I worked for the pineapple company for 40 years. The whole time I paid taxes. I don't say nothing. I don't grumble. I never get nothing from them. But today, all paid back. And so from that, you know, he won these people's hearts by just taking them out to lunch. And so that became his trademark. And these little tiny things that no one else was doing, that he just did because that's the person who he was. And you see these glimpses of the man. To me, yeah, that those are priceless things.
And those details that you glean, those must influence the physical performance as well, I would think. It gives you a sense of the person's stature or not so much.
Well, the physicality comes after the written word, for me anyway. I mean, I write the piece, and then as I write the piece and as I begin to tell it, as you tell it, you get a feel for how that person would stand, how he carries himself, and you know, how he would speak and things like that. And that's just a matter of just inhabiting the character. But certainly the glimpses of humanity that you see when you're doing someone's story like that, or you see these little gems that pop up that are priceless. Those are the things I want to capture because those are the jewels. And, it's rare to find things like that. And when you include them in a story, it just makes that story come alive. And that's the whole point of doing a lot of this story for me, is making things come alive for the audience.
Are there, do you find that there are certain audiences that are more receptive to the storytelling, or that you enjoy more as far as addressing, or is it just you're always, an audience can maybe sometimes change a performance or bring out different things about that character that you're presenting?
Oh, certainly. Every performance is a dance between me as a storyteller and the audience, because I'm feeding off the audience and the audience is feeding off me. And it's this back and forth that goes on through the entire performance. Certainly, I think if you perform in front of an audience that really knows story, that they see a lot of storytelling and they get it immediately and they're riding that wave with you. That's you know, very easy, and yeah, you the energy can really soar on that. To me, however, the most rewarding things are, you know, you tell stories to people who have never seen anything like this before, and all of a sudden, you know, you can see them, they catch on to it, and all of a sudden they want more. It's my belief that it's all about contact. It's about being 100% present with someone, because in our current society, we don't get a lot of that. You know, if you get 5 minutes with someone in your life per day that actually is just 100% there, just listening to you and connecting with you, I think that you're lucky, especially because, you know, we're constantly running around, you know, watching television, watching our phones, watching computers and things like that. We are disconnected. But when someone is physically just 100% there with you and not thinking about dinner, not thinking about laundry, just there listening to you, that is something I think that we desperately need, but we can't really identify. But when we feel it, we want more of it. And that, to me, is what I see with people who are brand new to storytelling. You know, it's like, you know, when they see this, they see someone who can really connect to them and have, you know, is telling them a really good story that they can feel, that they can lose themselves in, then they definitely want more.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I guess as far as audiences go, again, like I was saying, that we're really young kids, you know, they're into stories, you know, that they're willing to go with you wherever they want to go. You know, once you get up into junior high, then you got, you know, different stories for young kids, you know, short, simple, but you know, you can have participatory stories. They're really into that. Little older kids, yeah, they still want to believe. They still able to pretend. As you start getting a little, you know, sixth grade, eighth grade, yeah, you got to be more real, more personal stories. High school and things like that, again, more real. Ghost stories are very popular. Teens and things like that. With adults, they want to hear more historic stories, more real stories, personal stories. Folk tales, not as much. Things from other cultures, however, you know, stories from other cultures. Yeah, you adults would like those, in my opinion. It's been my experience when dealing with telling stories to people who know stories. You know, then you can go. They'll go wherever you want to go, and they'll be with you.
I see you surfing, word surfing, when you're like with a really kind of, they're hanging on your every word kind of thing.
Again, like I said, it's that interaction between the audience and the teller. It's this energy trade back and forth. And like I said, I think it's like a wave, this energy waves, and you come up there, and if you're really, you know, sometimes, I've experienced it a few times, you're just like riding this wave of energy, and all of a sudden you say, okay, now deliver the next line. And then, you know, the audience reacts, and then, you surf even higher. That is magic when that happens. Again, but I think to me, the most rewarding things, again, are when people have not seen storytelling before. They're brand new to it, and they're kind of skeptical and saying, okay, what is this all about? And it's like one of those things, I think, it's like opera, I think. If you go to a really good opera or you see a really good storyteller as your first experience, wow, you know, you want more. And I think, again, it's about connection, that people feel that, you know, because as a storyteller, I'm there 100%. I'm present, and I'm in the story, and I'm the conduit for the story, and I'm not thinking of anything else. I can't. I'm delivering, you know, the story to these people, and it's that interaction between the audience and the teller. I think older audiences, you know, they still remember radio the radio plays from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I mean, I still love listening to the old-time radio stories, you know, Suspense and, you know, X Minus One, Dimension X, all these Sherlock Holmes mysteries, CBS Mystery Theater. They still remember those types, you know, listening to the radio and, you know, having their imagination going wild. For a new generation who have not experienced that, you know, well, podcasts is the closest thing we have. But still, that type of, again, that imagination where you just, this is words and you're creating the images in your mind. Once you can get through those things, yeah, they understand those things. And again, they'll go with you.
And I'd just like to remind everybody again, we're talking with Alton Chung here, storyteller extraordinaire, and you're here with Lynn on Local Color. And I am really wanting to talk to you about your fascination, or so it seems, with ghost stories. Mm-hmm. It seems like that's a big part of the body of the work that you do.
Well, it's part of what I do. It's certainly what I started out with. It's a very niche market, and that, you know, around Halloween, certainly people like to hear ghost stories. Outside of that, not so much, unless I'm specifically requested, or like, you know, if I'm specifically doing a teen show, they like to hear that. You know, certainly for teenagers, the gorier, the better. But again, to me, was my first experience in telling stories. And because, like I said, growing up in Hawaii, things are different in Hawaii. And when I was growing up, you know, everyone had stories about the weird things that happened over at this place, or, you know, a friend of a friend saw these types of things. Growing up, I heard a lot of those stories. I don't hear them as much now as an adult when I'm in Hawaii. I'm sure that within families, among friends, it might still be going on. But that whole era of, like, the plantation days, growing up in the plantations were, you know, a real big part of Hawaii's economy. That's all gone now. And so I do a lot of oral histories in which I go and interview old-timers about what it was like in those old days and what kind of stories they tell, what kind of things they did was rascal times, or, you know, what kind of weird things that happened. And you get bits and pieces here and there. But certainly I don't feel it was, you know, I think we're losing a lot of that richness. But again, yeah, ghost stories are near and dear to my heart. I love telling them. I love hearing them. And that's just one of my proclivities.
Do you think the scientist in you maybe likes to sort of gather that sort of supernatural to sort of sift out what is behind the fear and the fable of a ghost story? Or,
well, to me, I think certain scientists, part of me, really likes to do the research, loves doing the research into the folktales. And to me, the best ghost stories are, here's a weird thing that's happening today in this house, and here's the history, and here's what we have found out that's, you know, in oral histories and newspaper accounts, historical record, what actually happened here on the site. And here's the connection we think we can make between what happened here and what's going on right now. And, you know, certainly, you know, then we sort of get into the paranormal science about how they detect things and how things are going on. I keep an open mind about things. Even as a scientist, I've seen too many things I cannot explain, too many bizarre things that I just go, I have no clue. And so I know there's lots of things that we can't explain with our current technology, but we will probably in the future. So that part of me is all saying, okay, well, that was odd. And, you know, I'm not going to say no, because I know I don't know everything. And, but I'll note that, yeah, this is something I cannot explain. And so that's, to me, that's the thrill. And that the best, again, here's what happens, what's happening now. Here's what happened in the past, the research part of it. That's fascinating. Here's what people are saying. Here's some folk tales. Here's some newspaper accounts. Here's some oral histories. And this is what we think, how the connections may be, what's going on. And certainly, okay, here's the science part, the paranormal science part that, you know, we don't really quite understand quite yet. To me, that's the complete package. If we can deliver a story that does that with the cultural, you know, nuances about this is why we think is happening here, you know, that's the thing that kind of makes me very interested in telling those types of stories.
Does anything spring to mind as far as that has to be one of the scariest, like, experiences anyone's ever shared with me. It's all in the notes. So.
there's a lot of really scary things that I've heard, but you know, it takes a long time to tell those stories. But I can tell you some short stuff that actually happened to me and my. There's in Portland, of course. You know, there's all these underground tunnels, the Shanghai tunnels, and I know the guy who runs the tours, and I've done a lot of his historic tours. I've done some of his classes. And I had my old roommate from grad school and his research partner were coming up to, they're going to a big scientific meeting in Portland. Well, they brought all their grad students with them and they had a free night. And I said, I got a deal for you. So I called up my friend and said, hey, can you squeeze us in? He said, oh man, I've got 80 people on this tour. And I said, oh, okay, well, this is the only night they're available. He said, okay, tell you what, you guys come, I'll put you in the very back tour, make sure no one gets lost. I said, great. And so we went tagging along and we all were, you know, strange things were happening around us and we had no clue. You know, we walked into this one place and all of a sudden we're the last ones out. We're always the last ones out of anywhere. And all of a sudden we're saying, you guys smell that? That's lavender. And I got hay fever. I can't smell anything, man. You know? And I said, okay, well, and we went to this one place and there was a rope, a nylon rope that was, you know, way in the corner, kind of so people can't walk over there. And we're at the very end of the tour and we can hear the people way in the front. He's telling the stories. And then we're just chit-chatting in the back. And I'm looking back there and I'm saying, guys, do you see that yellow rope? And they go, yeah. I think it's swaying. And we look and I said, there's no wind here. We're underground. There's no one down there. But it looks like it's swaying. The guy said, no. It looks like there's a black piece of gauzy cloth that's swaying in front of it. And I'm going, that's kind of odd. And, you know, so I take a picture of it and I said, okay, we move along. And there's a bend and I can hear the guide saying, oh, and this is the part of the tunnel that we hear the whistler. He just whistles. We don't know why. And I had my digital recorder on because we're recording my friends and I talking to each other. And the next day, we're listening back, just listening to ourselves talking about the discussion, what we are experiencing. And we hear someone whistle, like someone's right up on the digital recorder whistling. And we look at each other going, no. But the best one was three of us, you know, I'm open-minded. My old roommate, he's kind of open-minded too. But his research person is a physical chemist. No, you can't feel it. You can't see it. You can't measure it. It doesn't exist. Well, he's the skeptic. And so there's a brick archway. I pop on through. I turn around, I take a picture of the physical chemist as he goes walking through the archway. Then he stops, gets this funny look on his face, and turns and looks back. My old roommate's the only one back in the room. He's like 10 feet away looking at him saying, what? And he doesn't say anything. He just kind of walks away. Then we meet all the graduate students for dinner afterwards. And we're sitting there, and I'm going through all the digital pictures. And I say, oh, hey, you know why that archway? What was going on there? He said, as I walked through the archway, I felt like someone tapped me on the shoulder. I mean, hard, tap, tap on my shoulder. And I turned around. I thought it was you. But you are 10 feet away. I said, yeah. And I said, I showed him the digital picture. And there's this big gold little orb right by his elbow. And I said, looky, looky. And he immediately ordered a double scotch. So fun things like that happen.
Oh,
I can't explain it.
Goodness. Oh, wow. You captured it on film.
Well, as
he felt it. Wow. That's wonderful. Well, thanks for sharing that, and I have goosebumps. So, and I guess I wanted to look a little bit at the storytelling. It's not very static, is it? Is it? I mean, do you feel like you tell the story the same every time, or?
No, not necessarily. I mean, there are certain things, especially if I'm telling a historic story. I got to get the facts absolutely right. Just because, you know, lots of times these things, I didn't live through this experience. I did research. And so inevitably someone will raise their hand after the performance saying, it wasn't like that, or you got this wrong. You know, and fine, okay, fine. Give me, you know, what actually happened. Let me change it. And I'll change my script. No problem. But so there are certain things that have to be the same. They have to be right on. But certainly the performance itself, it does depend upon the audience. You know, if the audience is really receptive and they're really there with you, then, you know, it's that give and take of energy. If the audience is just kind of tired and they're kind of just like, oh, convince me, you know, that just pulling back, then as a performer, I have to use a lot more energy just to kind of amp myself up to go and, you know, get the performance going, you know. So certainly having a receptive audience that's very enthusiastic, yeah, it makes things a lot easier, and the performance does change. And at least that's been my experience anyway.
Okay. Before we wrap up here, I appreciate you sharing your scary stories. is there anything else about your storytelling and what you're compassionate about? Because you obviously have a great deal invested in what you do, and it's you can hear it in your voice, you can hear it in how you deliver and kind of become the people who are telling the story. Mm-hmm. And in this, as you described to me, a platform storytelling. Mm-hmm. Is there anything about the process that you think is important that we really haven't touched on in our conversation?
Well, I think, again, the passion for the stories is it's giving voice to the stories, to these people, and honoring them a lot of the time. You know, there's a saying that you die twice. Once when, you know, you physically die, and the last time is when no one repeats your name or your story. And part of it is, you know, a lot of these historic stories, I honor the people who are telling, I'm telling their story again, or people who give me their stories and saying, here, you tell it. Again, honoring that and telling them, as I have received the stories, telling the stories and sharing with other people. Certainly sharing different cultures. It's been, you know, from my experience, this is what I can tell. This is what I feel like I know something about. And sharing it with new ears and people who may have not had the same experiences that I have had. And sharing that that cultures and viewpoints and giving voice to stories that people who rather not tell their own stories. To me, that's a gift, and it's a service, and it's a something that I treasure and honor.
And must be overwhelmingly satisfying, especially to have people like receive it so well and to be so eager to hear what you have to say and what you have to share.
Oh, certainly. I mean, that is also always very rewarding to open people's ears to stories. And, you know, stories is a gateway to reading. And that's a lot of what I do is, you know, for education, for kids who, let's say, you know, they you know, I don't like reading. All of a sudden they hear a story saying, wow, there's more of this? Oh, yeah. You know, here, this is how you can get more. Go to the library, get these stories. Because to me, that's, if I can get more kids to read, that's a big thing for me, because that's how I learned, was being very curious about reading and reading a lot. That's something I think if more people do, they broadens their outlook, their viewpoint, their compassion, and their availability to be compassionate.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, my
pleasure. I really appreciate you being here with us today. And we have been talking with wonderful Alton Takayama Chong. And thanks so much for tuning in to Your Coast Community Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.